Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the 155th edition of the Feuerstein's Fire Internet Soccer Show. I'm your host, Daniel Feuerstein. I'll give you an American perspective of our clubs, leagues, players, national team, and other fabulous moments. You can get your daily reading from me and other writers at soccernewsday.com. And don't forget to listen to this program on mtrradio.com. Ladies and gentlemen, chat room is open. Come on in. Discuss whether you like amongst yourselves. If you have a question for me, I'll try to answer to the best of my abilities as much as possible. And let me just go on and say Operation Cakewalk has been a success. Operation Cakewalk, even though it had a bit of a problem in the first half in match number two of the group, it is still a success. Because not only did they level the match, even though it was a bit undeserved, they still found a way to put three more goals past the Cubans. And the final scoreline of that Group C match in the Gold Cup, United States 4, Cuba 1. So as we total situation, for the U.S. men's national team, as we all know, tomorrow night is the final group game between the U.S. and Cuba, 8 o'clock Eastern, over at Rentschler Field in Hartford, Connecticut. A great job by Chris Wondolowski. He has broken out. Now, we all know what the opponents were in CONCACAF. Yes, we all know Belize, Cuba. Not world beaters at all. Belize, a Central American side in the UNCAF. You have Cuba in the Caribbean, but we all know about the political problems there, and we will not go into it. But the truth of the matter is that the Cubans have no league, and the players on Belize, a few have played for a professional side in Central America, and at the same time, it's one of those situations where the players or the lack of talent should be a lot better when the USA is involved, meaning it should have been what it is. Between four from both sides. From both games, I should say, and that was fantastic. 10 goals for, 2 goals against. Yes, you don't like to see the U.S. get scored on when you take on these minnows like Cuba and Belize, but just remember, for a country like Belize, this is like their World Cup because they know they're not going to qualify for a tournament. For a country like Belize and Cuba, they hope to qualify. Belize, there's no way they're going to qualify unless they somehow break out and just light the UNCAF on fire and become a real danger team through World Cup qualifying. If they ever get to a hexagonal in World Cup qualifying, that would be the biggest party in the Central American country. And if you are of Belize descent, please, this is nothing against you guys at all. I think you're more realistic on what you have to go through just to get to a hexagonal. Forget even a hexagonal, possibly, just to get into the semifinal round of qualifying. And we'll see what happens when the next cycle comes for Russia 2018, and we'll see what the CONCACAF situation will be once Brazil is over at the end of next summer. And while I have to say that this has been a fantastic Gold Cup so far, I think we're seeing some quality we haven't seen in a while. Martinique, of course, the Department of France, the department. That's like saying you're going to Bloomingdale's and just going to go get some shoes or you're going to get some shirts. You know what I mean? But obviously, the players have to go to the French national team first before they play for their country. And it would be interesting to see if Thierry Henry ever pulls something like that. Not saying like I'm expecting him to or I'm going to be surprised if he does. But we'll see if he ever does something like that, even though he has said that he probably won't do it. But you never know. He might. He's eligible. We'll see what happens. And even though I'm trying to start it off with the U.S. national team, I want to go to Fox Soccer. I want to go to Fox and Fox Soccer Channel, even though we all know it's all going to end on August 17th for them. Let me say right off the bat that when you have broadcasters at the stadium calling the games, let's be honest, it is so much better than calling it from a studio. The first game, or the first group games on July the 7th, between Canada and Martinique, Panama and Mexico, you had the broadcasters in the Rose Bowl. Absolutely fantastic. But then it all changed. It all changed because everyone decided to go to the studio. It all changed because everyone decided that we're not going to go anymore on the road to these different venues in the U.S. to call the games. It will all be done in the studio, with the exception of USA versus Cuba, because the game was on Fox National. Gus Johnson, Eric Winalda at the stadium, at Rio Tinto, fantastic. But here's the next question right now. USA versus Costa Rica, at the same time Belize versus Cuba, Group C. Are we going to see broadcasters in the stadium on Fox Soccer? Because Group B tonight, regardless of how good or how bad these teams are in Group B, once again, Brian McBride, John Strong, fantastic job by these gentlemen, but a bad, bad job by Fox to have them call the game inside a studio. And this is where I'm getting nervous when it comes to Fox hosting and broadcasting the 2018 and 2022 World Cups, and let's also be honest, the 2015 Women's World Cup will be in Canada. The question comes up, are they going to be cheap by not sending broadcasters or only one main pair to Canada, as well as the other two men's FIFA World Cups? Because this is a broadcast network. Outside of the NFL and outside of Major League Baseball, in the stadiums is where Fox is lacking when it comes to the game in this country. You know they've already given up on Fox Soccer and Fox Soccer Plus, because they lost their bread and butter in the English Premier League. Forget about what they're going to do with their other properties. You know they're going to go through Sky Sports, their sister network, when it comes to the UEFA Champions League, the UEFA Europa League. as well as CONCACAF Champions League, when you just bring in the signal and you don't bother sending anyone to these stadiums. They are cheap. They are terrible. And in my opinion, I think the broadcasters, as well as the studio hosts, I think they deserve better. Because this is why I fear they're not going to put in a lot of effort into sending people physically to the stadiums. I can understand a little bit with the CONCACAF Champions League because, let's be honest, Central America can be a little bit, but I can understand that a little bit. But the truth is, it's not what it should be. In my opinion, if you want to be serious about this, send your announcers to the stadiums. Don't do it when you think it's necessary. Do it because you have to. We talk about quality, and I understand Gus Johnson. There's still some people upset about Gus Johnson being the face or the voice of American soccer. The point is this. Don't blame him because you think he's dumbing it down for all of us. Blame Fox for putting him into that spot. Other than that, I think he's called the games wonderfully. I think Gus Johnson's done a fantastic job bringing in the proper excitement to the games. And he has done, in my opinion, while still learning the sport and still giving it his best, I still say he's done a fantastic job when to be excited, when not to. And in my opinion, the Cuba game, the second goal for the United States, the Joe Corona goal, that, in my mind, was the best call in the two matches he's done in this CONCACAF Gold Cup. Yes, I am putting my stamp of approval on Gus Johnson. Sometimes you need someone who might not be a fan of the sport, but if he learns it, he watches it, he gets it. He might need some help still. He still might need some help. And you know what? I don't mind giving him that leeway, and I don't mind giving him that space. Gus Johnson knows a lot about the NBA, the NFL, college sports for college football and college basketball. And if he wants to add soccer to his repertoire, then you know what, my friends? How about you show him the same damn love that I am? I don't mind it. Gus Johnson, if you are listening to this program, my friend, you need help with the lingo. You still need some help here. I am willing to give you my services to make you feel better, to make you get calmer. Gus Johnson, I got your back, because we're from New York, my friend. We're both from New York. I got your back, my friend, because I believe that you are becoming a good, strong candidate as a soccer announcer. The only thing you need help is your detractors, and I'll make sure they understand that I don't mind it from you. You've done a damn good job so far. Yes, you still need some help. You need some tweaking, still a little rough around the edges, but I still believe, Gus Johnson, you are becoming a top-notch soccer broadcaster for television, and I hope you do a damn good job the rest of this Gold Cup. Ladies and gentlemen, I have a great show for you tonight. Not only will we talk about the Red Bulls 4-0 shellacking over l'Impact de Montreal, but of course, we're going to talk about something that's a little bit worrisome when it comes to our youth national teams, especially at the under 20 level. And to help me discuss this situation is my good friend Kartik Krishnayar, of course, former communications officer of the North American Soccer League. And Kartik, you know, Kartik, before we answer that question, here's something that's really interesting that's going on in the 2013 calendar year. Jurgen Klinsmann has been brought in to make our senior national team better. He's come over to make them at least get to the next level, a higher level of attack, of confidence, structure, and it's gone very well. And as we look at Chepo de la Torre from Mexico, not counting this Gold Cup tournament because obviously it's a different roster, but you're seeing at the moment, in my opinion, Kardik, a reversal of fortunes because the Mexican youth national teams have been doing very well, including the Olympic victory of a gold medal in London last summer, and our under-20s have just not been there. Our Olympic players did not qualify for London last summer. Has this so far been a 50-50 situation, something positive and something negative?
As far as the Klinsmann hiring?
Yes.
Well, the jury's out on the Klinsmann hiring. I mean, I think the U.S. is going very well in qualifying, better than we did under Arena the first cycle, better than we did under Sampson in his cycle, certainly better than the cycle with Bradley, about the same as the second cycle under Arena. So, yeah, I guess qualifying is going very well, but we'll see. I mean, Coach Bradley won a Gold Cup. He got us to a final of the Confederations Cup. He got us to another final of the Gold Cup. Well, got us to two more of the Gold Cup finals. Obviously, that last Gold Cup final in 2011, it didn't end well, and that ended his tenure. He also got us out of the group stage. He won our group and got us out of the group stage in the World Cup and lost to a Ghana team in extra time. That was a very good team. A team that, quite frankly, got cheated out of being a semifinalist team by Suarez and his hand of God antics. But so I think the bar is pretty high. I don't know that he can match Coach Bradley's achievements. Maybe he will, but I think the jury's out on that. As far as the youth national teams are concerned, Daniel, they've been regressing pretty steadily over the course of the last 6 years. You remember 2007? Remember 2005 and 2007? We had very good U-20 teams. 2005, we were unlucky in the sense that we won our group, which included Argentina, the eventual champions. We actually won the group, and we beat them head-to-head. And we, because of Italy finishing third in another group, we ended up playing them in the round of 16. It's just sometimes that stuff happens in U-20 with that third-place team. We saw it even this year with Ghana coming out of our group, finishing third, and then the teams that they got to play, because Ghana had been an underachieving team in the group stage until they played us, but very good team, as we know. That kind of happened with us in 2005. And in 2007, with Jose Altidore, Freddie Adu, Robbie Rogers, Danny Santella, Michael Bradley, obviously Sal Zizzo, really good, strong team, Tony Beltran, big part of that team, among others, Dax McCarty, and names are just coming back to me as we're talking about this. That team got to the quarterfinals of the U-20 World Cup, and we're unlucky. We lost an extra time to Austria in the quarterfinals in a match which we ended on 10 men. So since then we've regressed. We haven't gotten out of the group stages. We obviously didn't qualify in 2011 for the U-20s. We didn't qualify for the Olympic tournament, as you said, in 2012. We've had difficulties at the U-17 level. I think this is where we need to go with this discussion. I think there's been a transition between college players and MLS academies, and you know some NASL and USL academies also, but mostly MLS. And that transition, in the long run, is going to pay off for us. But the short term, it's made things a little more difficult.
It really has, and obviously, I mean, you know, you look at the rosters. Especially that 2007 team that did so well in Canada. I mean, yeah, start off with a draw against South Korea, a 6-1 shellacking at the Olympic Stadium in Montreal against Poland, and then a big, big 2-1 win over Brazil in Ottawa, and then you go and win an extra time against Uruguay in the round of 16, and then we lose 2-1, unfortunately, an extra time against Austria. But, I mean, these names, I mean, everyone knows Chris Seitz, Nathan Sturgis, Michael Bradley, Freddie Adu, Jose Altidore, Danny Santella, Dax McCarty, Andre Akpan, I mean, Tony Beltran. I mean, if you really think about it, this is a roster, in my mind, that is MLS, you know, rich with MLS players. Of course, Michael Bradley was playing in Europe at the time on this roster. Freddie Adu, we all know about Freddie Adu. Thomas Rongen, who coached the 07 squad in Canada, the 09 squad in Egypt. Why has this regression became so large for the U.S. youth, the under-20s, basically? Because is there a problem between the NCAA and some of these other players in the MLS youth academies as well as the lower league academies?
Yeah, I think that's definitely part of it. I also think that we had, like every other country, we go through cycles. I mean, it seems like even the top country. Well, actually, even the top countries go through cycles. Germany had a down cycle in the mid part of the last decade, which Jurgen Klinsmann helped bring them out of. Spain obviously now has a system, and the thought is Spain will be permanently good. But we don't know that. We don't know that. In spite of the success at the youth level currently, while they're dominating the full international level. Obviously, Brazil's had some dips. Italy had a dip recently. And they've just come out of that under Prandelli. So everything goes through cycles. And I think at the youth level, we've gone through a bad cycle. And honestly, Bradenton hasn't worked as well as it did initially. That's a big part of it. Obviously, I'm speaking of the Bradenton Academy in Florida, U.S. Mm-hmm. Soccer's academy that they manage with IMG, where we put the elite players, or who we determined as the elite players. Let me remind everybody, Clint Dempsey was not considered a, quote, elite player and was not invited to Bradenton. Of course, they're like the Landon Donovan, Bobby Condi, Marcus Beasley, Abuchi, I mean, Freddie Adu, Josie Altidore, they all were, but Clint Dempsey was not. So that shows a glaring omission in the setup. But I think Bradenton is not producing the players it was, and I think that's a big part of it. I know Richie Williams and Jimmy Rooney, who I'm friendly with, correspond with quite often. They liked the class that they had this year, that they took down to the CONCACAF championships. It just didn't go our way. Maybe some of those guys will turn into good U-20 players. Wilmer Cabrera had a couple guys he liked there. One of the issues is some of these guys that are leaving Bradenton early and are going to Europe. They're getting European contracts, and then things aren't going right. Sebastian Leggett left the U.S. youth national team setup, went to West Ham, got into a car accident, really hasn't produced since then. Charles Rankin was at Bradenton, was a player we really, really, really had high hopes for. Even some top European clubs, Arsenal, Inter, and others were interested, sniffing around. And he ended up going to Hoffenheim, and I think he may not even be playing the sport anymore. Joseph Gaia, a player I watched from the Tampa area, another guy that happened with, went to Hoffenheim. I guess he's still in the system, but not really playing much. And then you have other guys that go over, and for whatever reason, it just doesn't work out for them at a young age. Eric Lehigh was a guy that went over at a very young age. He eventually got the opportunity to play with Aston Villa, but by that time he was already at the point where he was going to have to be a full international, not a youth international. Will Packwood's a player currently that I like a great deal, a defender at Birmingham City, but he's gotten hurt. He just broke his leg. So he's a guy we would have had under 20. Yeah, and I think Will Packwood would have made a pretty big difference in this tournament. That having been said, Daniel, I mean, we're going to critique, obviously, in these next couple of minutes this youth setup, but we were in a group with France, the eventual champions, Spain, mm-hmm. you know what, mm-hmm. and Ghana, who was very, very good. It was the group of death. You look on paper at those four sides, we're fourth of those four. Looking at it on paper, any which way, I think actually France finished second in the group, but that they had, at least on paper, a more experienced team than Spain. Spain just came out of the gates really spectacularly. And then, you know, caught an Uruguay team that was getting hot in the knockout stages. And Ghana, very good team. Ghana, strong, particularly as we saw on the counterattack against us. So, and the thing I loved about the Ghanaian team and I loved about watching Ghana the last couple years is we've always talked about how indisciplined a lot of African teams are. We know this now because we've played Ghana seven times in international competitions at all levels and lost seven times. But they have guys that are much more disciplined tactically. The first touch is better than most other African countries. The discipline, shape, So I actually enjoy watching Ghana. I gained a lot of begrudging respect for them as they've eliminated us from tournament after tournament. But
as much as me too, exactly.
Yeah, I've become a fan of Ghana. I will say that if we're not going to win a tournament, I'm pulling for them, and I in fact pulled for them in this tournament, and they lost on penalties to France in the semifinals.
Absolutely. I mean, I have to give them respect. I mean, look. Ghana has proven to be a better side. It has to probably do with coaching that has probably given these players, you know, to give them more respect, maybe to tell them to respect their opponents a little bit more, not to be so, I guess, I mean, maybe the word not violently, but at least not to run around and acting like you're disrespecting your opponent. You have to go out there. I mean, I'm not saying you have to completely respect them, but at least to say that, look, respect them enough where you're not going to pull in these typical shenanigans that maybe certain African national teams are known to do.
Yeah, and I think it's also a more stable environment. I don't want to get too deep into the politics here, but Ghana has just been more stable economically and more stable politically. No military junta and no takeovers like Cote d'Ivoire and Liberia and Togo and some of them. We saw what happened. Even to the Cup of African Nations a couple of years ago. I think that that's certainly the case. But when we look with Ghana, when we look at our setup compared to Mexico's, I don't know how necessarily to explain this, because I guess maybe the 2011 Gold Cup is one thing, because obviously they won it with that golden generation coming good. The generation that won the 2005 U-17 World Cup. But it seems like Mexico, when they've struggled at the youth level, the group that come out of the struggles at the youth level have performed better at the full international level than the teams that have done really well at the youth level. So, I mean, you're looking at a team that won the U-17 World Cup 2 years ago, then went and won, some of the same players went and won the Olympic gold medal last year, just shocking the world. I mean, let's face it, what an accomplishment. You know, Brazil has just not been able to win that gold medal, and they've been wanting that prize so badly. It's been a deadly serious thing in Brazil, and I know that final last year, which Mexico beat them in, is seen as a moment of great shame for Brazilian football. But Daniel, I mean, you can't take it away from Mexico. They went out there and they beat them, and they fully earned that first place medal. But for some reason, they've had a problem transitioning those guys into the full national team each time it's happened, each time they've had this great youth run. Whereas when they've had teams that have struggled at the youth level, they've been able to kind of transition a little better to the full national team level, which, again, I think is a little bit odd. I'm not sure how to attribute that, what to attribute that to. In our case, there's been a direct correlation between how we performed at the youth level a few years earlier and then how we perform at the full international level. I mean, our best teams historically were teams, the core of the 1989 U-20 team that got to the semifinals ended up being the team that hosted the World Cup in 94 and then got to the semifinals of the Copa America in 1995 and beat Brazil in the World Cup in 98, that core. Bob Gansler initially took some of those guys brought them into the national team, and then Bora kept going, Bora and Sampson. And then the 1999 U-17 team that got to the semifinals with Landon Donovan and DeMarcus Beasley winning the Golden Shoe and the Golden, the Golden Shoe and the Silver Shoe. I forgot what the awards are called. The U-17
Golden
level.
Ball, Silver Ball?
Yeah, right. Golden Ball and Silver Ball. That team, those guys, and Gooch was there then, and I don't think Bobby Tommy was on that team. It was 2 years later. That team also, and the U-20 team that played that year and did very well in the U-20 World Cup in 99. I remember Danny Caleb scoring the goal on a header against England to beat them. Taylor Twellman had one of the best tournaments. The core of that team ended up being the team that won the Gold Cup in 2002. That's when Beasley got bloodletted into the team. World Cup 2002, we go to the quarterfinals. Obviously, we end up being ranked in the top five in the world, breeze through qualifying for the 2006 World Cup, and enter that 2000 and win the Gold Cup in 2005. Enter the 2006 World Cup as a top five country. You know, obviously, we get shellacked by the Czech Republic in the first match, and The rest is kind of sad history. But the core of that team had been really successful at the youth level. So that's why I'm concerned. I know at the youth level you don't necessarily want to overemphasize results. It's about learning and training and getting to understand the game and getting matches. But at the same time, I think we have an issue where historically if we perform well at the youth level, and even look at the team I talked about in 2007. I mean, two of our three most influential players currently on the senior national team, in my opinion, now you can argue about other people, are Michael Bradley and Jozy Altidore, both off of that team. So, and that was a youth national team that was really successful. Are we going to see really core national team players from the 2009 U-20 team that lost out at the group stage, who got embarrassed by South Korea in the final match, ended the game on 9 men and could have ended it on 7, really, because they were so indisciplined? No, I don't think we are. And are we going to see guys off of that Olympic qualifying team that failed so miserably? Probably not. That was the case with 2004 also. Obviously, Donovan and Beasley were still of age, and they were part of the qualifying. Obviously, the loss at Jalisco to Mexico, infamous because of Landon Donovan's urinating, obviously, during that match. But other than Donovan and Beasley, who had been successful at the youth level to that point and were already full internationals for the U.S., the rest of that U-23 team didn't really integrate into the full national team squad. That's the thing we have to be concerned about. I certainly think, though, that Jürgen Klinsmann has a hand in picking the coaches, and I think Cabaret Ramos has the right idea. I just don't know that we have the players yet that have been raised to play the way he's wanting them to play. He learned that. He abandoned any pretext of trying to play a style against France because the first game against Spain had gone so badly. Second game against France, we're getting shellacked. They're just not finishing chances in the first 30 minutes, and it's 0-0, and TAP went to a much more pragmatic kind of 4-4-2 or 4-2-2-2, abandoned the 4-3-3. And from that point on, I think we had the better of the play, and France ended up winning the World Cup. So that was a promising game. Then we obviously went into the game against Ghana needing to get something from that, and Ghana needed the game too, and they were just we weren't going to beat them. Let's just put it that way. We weren't going to beat them that day. So there's not a whole lot to criticize about that because performance was horrible. Don't get me wrong, but Ghana was going to win that day the way they played. They played they played lights out that day because they knew they needed to beat us to get through.
No, absolutely, I agree. I think Tab Ramos was on to something. I think Tab Ramos, if he remains the head coach for the under-20 national team and maybe qualifies for the next under-20 World Cup, I don't know where it will be in 2015, but I think he deserves at least a second opportunity to qualify.
Yeah, I think it's about teaching kids at this level. And again, I mean, we were looking at doing some things differently this time and trying to play stylistically very differently than we had played previously. And I think that's an important thing. Tab was trying to teach the guys that. The U-17 level is another concern, though, and we talked about that. And I don't know. I think we're in a position, Daniel, where we have to rethink Bradenton, and we also have to look at some of the things that are going on player development-wise, outside of the U.S. youth national system and MLS academies. One of the top academies is the Chivas Academy, Keith Costigan, who I think most people know from Fox Sports, but is also a UEFA A-license coach. It's just taking over that academy. So looking forward to some more good players coming out of there. And Eric Rivaldo, who I've spoken to about this subject at length, he's got some really interesting young players he's brought through Cal FC and now the Atlanta Silverbacks that maybe have not gotten the look in the U.S. system. When all the raves about Chris Klute to me, about him maybe being one of the best left backs that we've ever produced as a country, and yet Ronaldo found him in the NPSL and plucked him from the NPSL, brought him to the Atlanta Silverbacks first team, Silverbacks reserve team is in the NPSL, and now he's with the Colorado Rapids starting match after match, you know, really on the periphery of the national team pool. So there's just a lot of guys that are slipping through the cracks.
Oh, absolutely, and sometimes I think, once again, this does seem to be political. I mean, nothing against Ramos when he made the squad, but apparently a player for FC Dallas and Zimmerman should have been, many people said, well, he should have been on this under-20 squad, and Todd Ramos didn't select him, and maybe because he felt that he wanted to pick someone else to be, or at least take the spot that Zimmerman was probably going to go after. You know, there's a lot of politics going on, whether it be MLS coaches, within U.S. soccer, NCAA.
I mean, we had that issue famously with Nevin Subotic, who's become a starter in the Champions League final for Borussia Dortmund. He grew up in the United States, grew up here in Florida, went to Bradenton, played for the U-17s, then got dropped from the U-20 team, and was essentially told at that time that there were about 10 American players who were as good as him in his age group, which obviously wasn't true. But we've had that issue with our coaches not looking at the talent in our pool properly and making some odd decisions. Now, I think that goes on everywhere. I mean, we scrutinize it here, and we get upset about it. I know we've been very upset about Subotic, and I for one, I mean, I got a lot of abuse on Twitter when I said it's great to have a guy that grew up in Florida who I consider to be an American. He considers himself an American to a large extent. Playing in the Champions League final, starting in the Champions League final, actually making a goal line clearance, if you remember. I got a lot of abuse for that, saying, oh, he's not American. He decided to play for Serbia instead. But, you know, he wanted to play for the United States, and we messed it up. But I think we scrutinize that a lot when I am pretty sure that happens everywhere, where there are guys that fall through the cracks. I know there are guys that England could use that end up playing for Trinidad or Jamaica. You know, they've lucked out now with Raheem Sterling. They identified him young enough that he decided to play for England, so playing for Jamaica. He was born in Kingston. But I know there are guys that England, the guys that when we see Trinidad and Jamaica here in CONCACAF, guys that should be playing for England. I mean, I know there are. And I'm sure Germany has issues like that. I'm sure France has a lot of issues like that with African countries. Drogba played for Cote d'Ivoire. I think that was a personal choice, but, you know, he certainly could play for France. He grew up in France. So
right.
It's not just us, guys. I mean, I know everyone wants to be very critical of U.S. soccer in missing on guys, but it's not just us.
Oh, no, absolutely. I agree. And, you know, I mean, how many times you see certain players who are born in a certain country, but, you know, they've been ignored for how long, like you've just said, and then they decide to go play for the country, you know, where their parents were born. I mean, that's just
right.
A whole big thing. I mean, it's not U.S. soccer's fault.
I think we've lucked out here with Mick Fiskerud. I think he's a player who's going to help us a lot. He obviously grew up in Norway, was born and grew up in Norway. His mother is American. Conversely, you know, we've been burnt with other guys. Breda Handelon spent the first 12 years of his life in this country. He decided to play for Norway instead of playing for the United States, and he's had a great career. Maybe not a great career, but he's had a good career in the Premier League. Certainly a very high level career in a top league. At Fulham, a club now owned by an American, in Shahid Khan. That was some big news over the weekend, and I think another great sign about the influence of us Yanks over in England in the Premier League.
Absolutely. I will slightly disagree with you about the 2009 under-20 side, because Breck Shea was on that side in Egypt. The one thing is this. I'll agree with you, because if he cannot piece together his performance on a mental aspect, I mean, we all know he's got the ability, but the mentality of him has been very, very inconsistent. If he can fix that up, I will say that he will definitely he'll definitely break out of that 2009 group.
Yeah, well, Daniel, you know, Breck Shea is a guy that I think As early as 2007, we were thinking he was going to be a big star in Europe, and he was going to be, you know, the next great American player. And I remember in 2008, really getting unhappy. There was talk of him going to Arsenal or Manchester United, one of these clubs. Unhappy that Bradley wasn't calling him into the full national team to at least get a look at him. I mean, in retrospect, Coach Bradley generally got the timing right on everybody. You know, I was complaining at the time he wasn't calling Kenny Cooper in. Turned out Kenny Cooper wasn't good enough to play for the United States at that level. I just thought he was, and I was wrong about that, and Coach was right. I was complaining that Altidore wasn't in at the right time, but then he did bring Altidore in to the point where he could contribute when we got to the World Cup in 2010, and, you know, he slowly brought him along. Shea was a guy that I think we had high hopes for, and a lot of Klinsmann's faith in him has been about the potential, his physical potential, not his mental issues, which you alluded to very, very articulately. Yeah, the jury's still out on him. I think he's certainly a guy that could contribute, but he's never really been a guy that I would say is like a natural go-getter type winner player in big games. He had some nice games in the playoffs in 2010 for FC Dallas, but certainly he hasn't done a whole lot with the national team in big games. He's done okay in some friendlies. And he was dreadful the other night against Cuba, and the Cubans really took advantage of him down that flank. I mean, they were mm-hmm. watching the game on that side of the field. He went to Stoke and hasn't played, whereas Jeff Cameron went to Stoke and has played every game. So, you know, it's not that they have a bias against Americans there, because clearly they signed two American guys, one played regularly at different positions. They would play Cameron because Cameron's versatile, we know this, but they would play him in a couple different places, and Shea didn't play at all.
I think the real thing there, Clark, when you go to England, it's more about the offensive type of players that you have. If Shea was a defender or a defensive midfielder, I think he would be used a lot, but instead he's an attacking player in the midfield. And you know, I mean, obviously this isn't Clint Dempsey or Landon Donovan, or else, you know, he would be out there, you know, no problems. But once again, you know, how is Breck Shea going to be on the national team if Stoke doesn't use him properly? And hopefully now with Mark Hughes running Stoke City, maybe, you know, Hughes will listen to Jurgen Klinsmann.
I think dramatically for him. I mean, let's not underplay, Daniel, that impact of that coaching change. I think Sparky going to Stoke could make a really big difference in Breck Shea's trajectory, because Sparky has always, and I saw him at Manchester City, obviously watched him at Fulham and QPR and Blackburn also, always used wingers well, which Tony Pulis didn't do, and always liked players who were tall and athletic. So Breck Shea actually fits both descriptions, fast winger, tall and athletic. Jeff Cameron will probably continue to play there. Maurice Adu went there, remember, and then they quickly loaned him out. Mo Adu, I think, is, look, I don't want to insult anyone, but by saying this, but I think you're better off going to a second division team in England than going to a top team in Scotland.
A Premier League team.
Yeah.
No, I'll agree with you. I mean, listen.
No, you're better going to Nottingham. Better off going to Nottingham Forest than you are going to Rangers or Celtic. And Rangers, obviously, now is not there. I think Maurice Adu actually regressed as a player in his development stages when he went to Rangers, because it was so simple. It was so easy. And he got lucky in the sense that Barry Ferguson, who was the captain of the team, got into like this drinking, had gone out and gotten drunk, him and Alan McGregor, and then they were doing the V sign on the sideline, pitch side of one of the games. So they got suspended, and Mo Adu had just signed. He'd just gone over from Toronto FC. He got thrown into the team and did well. And kept playing for the next 3 years in a league that is worse than MLS. I know that there's a lot of history in Scotland, but it is not as good a league as MLS. Not even close mm-hmm. at this point. I think it's only slightly mm-hmm. better than the NASL, to be honest with you. And mm-hmm. he went to England. You know, when Rangers have the financial team, he goes to England. He can't hack it. He's clearly not a good, you know, the top players in Scotland can't, most of them can't play even with the worst Premier League teams in England. They're hardly good enough to play in the Championship. So, you know, I think Maurice Adu's career path is instructive for American players. You know, just stay at home. Stay in MLS if you get an offer from Scotland. You get an offer from England, then consider it. Then consider going, or you offer from Germany. But I think it hurt Carlos Boca Negra's game being at Rangers also. I just do not think that league is a good league. I think that league is borderline semi-professional in some respects when you face mm-hmm. some of the teams there. So I think that was the issue with Molyneux. But, you know, I think we have a lot of American guys, and if you want to spend the next couple of minutes looking at them, a lot of American guys that have gone abroad in the last couple of years that I think have an opportunity this upcoming season to make an impact. I mean, obviously, maybe we'll start with Josie Daniel. Maybe we'll talk about him for a little bit.
Exactly. I mean, you know, he's got another opportunity over at Sunderland, and, of course, Paulo Dacanio is now running Sunderland, so we'll see what happens.
Yeah.
If it's going to be a good marriage or it's going to be a hellfire, brimstone and everything.
That's a good team for him to be with. I think. I mean, Dacanio, we know his you know political stuff and his fiery personality. I think that's a team where if you do well, the fans will embrace you. They have a rabid supporters base, and I think also that they have. In Adam Johnson, Seb Larson, and James McClain, some very good wide players that will be mm-hmm. able to get Josie the ball in the area, get him into some advantageous situations where he can finish chances, where he's going to get good chances which he can finish.
Absolutely. I guess, finally, about talking this whole situation, I think we agree Todd Ramos for the under-20s is on he's on the right path, and hopefully where the next under-20 World Cup will be, obviously be in 2 years. They haven't said what country yet, or FIFA hasn't said where it's going to be in 2015. But when it does happen, we'll go and find out. But I think overall, Tab Ramos is on the right path. He just we'll see who's up next and who's going to return from this 2013 squad. But at the same time, Kardik, I really think everyone from the NCAA, the NCAA, MLS, NASL, USL, whoever, we all need to come together. We got to hammer out things, and we got to make sure that the best players, whether it is during the college season, these U.S. Development season, or maybe even reserve leagues in our professional leagues, they all come together. And I'm not saying I'm demanding a trophy or anything like that. I'm just saying we have to get out of the group stage more than just once every 3, 4, 5 years because, not getting out of the group in Egypt in 2009, not qualifying for out of CONCACAF in 2011, and not getting out of the group in Turkey this past June, July, you know, I think right now it's a little bit of an embarrassment, and we have such an abundance of riches here in this country. It doesn't matter who the players are. It doesn't matter where their parents came from.
Totally.
They're playing for the United States. We got to get them out. We got to at least get out of the group stage and do it the next couple of tournaments because you know it's really really a big negative right now.
Daniel, my former colleague who I'm still a dear friend. He calls games on Fox Soccer. Tim calls some Premier League games. Saw him call the Gold Cup the other night. Dave Denholm. He used to say we had the strategy in these tournaments, which is 4 points and pray. And that seems to be the strategy, is to get like, 1 point out of your first two matches or get 4 points, or get some combination of points that will get you a 4 points, and then just pray. And that happened in 2008 Olympic tournament when Stu Holden and Tasha Kleisman jumped in the wall, black kick of the game, right, we saw he was obstructed, the ball goes under, and on towards the goal and were eliminated. I mean, things like that. I mean, we actually had another game that we lost to Nigeria after that, but we just see that game out and we're through to the next stage. We're very bad at elimination games, and that's something that goes all the way down from the top of the senior national team right on down. I mean, taking the Gold Cup out of it because you're playing inferior competition in the Gold Cup other than Mexico, and you know this year potentially Costa Rica is pretty strong, but. In elimination games and major tournaments, major FIFA tournaments, we're very poor. I mean, we beat Spain in the Confederations Cup, which is unbelievable, one of the great moments I think of all our lives. But you look at the Ghana game in 2006, you look at the Ghana game in 2010. You look at that South Korea game, the U-20 World Cup in 2009. You look at that Austria game in 2007, the U-20 World Cup, the Holland game, and the Nigeria game I talked about in the Olympics in 2008. You talk about the game against El Salvador last year at Olympic qualifying, and then obviously the Ghana game the other day, or now it's been about 2 weeks, in the U-20 World Cup, now in 2013. And we're talking about a mentality thing. Our mentality not being good in elimination games. Us waiting for things to go wrong. And that's what Dave always said. It would be 4 points and pray. Well, you even go back to the Poland game. And I think that's where he started that saying was 2002 World Cup when we just need a point against Poland and they kill us. And we get lucky because Portugal was down to 9 men and South Korea, a credit to them, they were very sporting. They all they needed was a draw to go through, but they fought and they won that game, and that put us through. But we've been very torn in these sorts of circumstances, and I think it's a mindset, it's a mentality. Maybe it comes from not emphasizing results at the youth level, but I don't think that's the case. I think our youth teams should emphasize results. And I mean, something I want to say also is I think perhaps we've, and I include myself in this, have been too critical of college soccer and have not appreciated what college soccer has done to develop some players rather quickly. Now, if guys go to 4 years, play 4 years of college soccer, they're already almost too old to make an impact. You know, by the time then they get into the full national team, they're 24 or 25, and you know, they don't have much of a shelf life. But we've had guys like Clint Dempsey and Oguchi Onye who have gone to school for 1 year or so, 1 or 2 years, who have then moved on, gone to Europe. Well, Dempsey went to the MLS first. Gooch went to Europe. Several examples of players like this that we've had that maybe developed that game in that one semester of college they played because they were getting games. The games meant something. MLS reserve games don't mean anything, okay? Let's just be honest about this. I'm glad MLS has brought the Reserve League back, and I really think it's a good thing they're working with USL on the Reserve League at this point. But the Reserve games mean nothing. They're meaningless. They're not competitive games, and they're games where you're playing really, you know, you're playing in front of no crowd. You're playing, you know, middle of the afternoon. There's nothing big about them. At least college soccer gives the guys a perspective on you know, playing in a competitive atmosphere in front of a crowd, people who care about the results, fans. Do I want our top players in college at 20 or 21? No. I think when they're 18, it's okay. And then at 19, they're playing for FC Dallas or they're playing for West Ham United or something like that. I'm cool with that. But I don't want them in college at 20 or 21. But I think, Daniel, my point is I think college, people like myself have just bashed NCAA soccer and said, this is killing us. You know, we don't want anyone going to college. We want everybody to be a professional by the time they're 17 or 18. And in some cases, that's not the best thing for the kids. I've come to that conclusion that it's on a case-by-case basis, but some of the kids do need a year or two of college soccer.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with you wholeheartedly. And, you know, Kardik, I think this has been a great topic to discuss. Hopefully these changes can come. And hopefully we can see this under-20 program, even our under-17s. Hopefully they'll get through out of a group stage and move on into the knockout stages, and let's see them continue to get better. I know you got another show coming up locally. I know you'll be on the Ultras, the live show.
I'll be on the Ultras, the live show at 9:30 for those of you that listen to that. Peter Brown and Uncle Ed. At Toronto. It's a great show. I know, Daniel, you've been on there, and you've had Peter on your show. So it's part of American Soccer Podcast we have out there. And let me also say, this is a shameless plug right now. Obviously, I write for WorldSoccerTalk.com, and we've got some new exciting developments coming in the next couple of weeks you'll hear about. But I want to recommend to everybody the United States Football Show, hosted by Robert Hay and Earl Reed. I think that's a show everyone will enjoy. If you want to get a good weekly show on U.S. soccer, that besides this one, Forrest Kings Fire is fantastic. I think the other one you want to listen to is Robert and Earl. they're independent and they take on the tough issues the way you have, Daniel. Not every show does that. I'll just leave it at that. I'm not going to name names, but I think that the show
ends up... Go ahead, Carter. Get the Tommy gun out and blow him away. No, but, you know, Carter, to be honest with you, look, there's a time when... Look, when we care about the game so much in this country, when we want our leagues to get better, to get bigger, and, of course, you know, to do it the right way, it has to be done the right way. Because if it doesn't go the right way, everything's going to fall apart. You know my stance of this whole New York City FC situation. Don Garber, in my opinion, has jumped the gun on this. He's, you know, in my opinion, he's brought the team in without actually – creating a stadium, because this was basically the league selling aside, and unfortunately, you know, he's forced it upon everyone that follows MLS, especially in the New York City area. Now you're going to have three teams in the area, not just the New York Red Bulls, but the Cosmos are back in the NASL coming August 3rd. And then you have this new team coming in 2015. It's just, we're not ready to be, you know, London slash America, you know what I mean? Because how many clubs are in London? Like, what, 20, 30, 500?
At least 20. I mean, everyone talks about the Premier League clubs, but they don't forget clubs like Brentford and Barnet and other Leighton Orient and Millwall and others that are in lower divisions. We're not there yet. I mean, I think New York obviously has the potential to be there eventually. My former boss at the NASL, Bill Pearson, he has to believe Los Angeles to be like London. I tend to disagree with him. I think Los Angeles is a lot less community-oriented than New York is. I think New York and maybe the Washington, D.C. areas are the two areas you could see that happening in first. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, some, maybe down the road, Los Angeles. I know maybe Peterson's right about L.A. My theory is it hasn't been tried in this country, so we don't know. I just think New York is probably more equipped to have multiple teams in different neighborhoods. You know, an ethnic team in Brooklyn, some teams in Queens. You could have more than one team in Queens, and maybe a team in Flushing, maybe a team in another part of Queens, or maybe even down by Jamaica, down south mm-hmm. southern part of Queens, team in Manhattan playing somewhere,
mm-hmm.
Randall Island. The Randall Island team could service Manhattan, Queens, and the Bronx. And then maybe you could have a team in Bronx. I mean, and then obviously you have your team in Harrison, in Jersey, in Red Bull, which is actually closer if you're in the financial district or you're close to
yep.
Penn Station, because the path train goes
yep.
from Penn Station to Harrison, you're actually
mm-hmm.
closer to the Red Bulls than you are to where the Cosmos are starting at Hofstra, but they hope to be Belmont in the NASL in the near future.
Mm-hmm.
You're much closer to them than you are to Belmont or to wherever the Man City team ends up. I mean, they're going to start at Yankee Stadium.
Yeah, but that venue's not going to be around for long, that's for sure, Kardec. And
they cannot play at Yankee Stadium more than 1 year. I'm telling you, Daniel, it's not a good thing if they're at Yankee Stadium more than one season.
No, it's not. And, Kardec, I'm from the Bronx. There's no place to put a stadium at all. I thought of maybe one area, which would be on Kingsbridge Road and Jerome Avenue, but that's going to be converted into indoor ice rinks now, the old Kingsbridge Armory. So that's the New York Rangers, Mark Messier, they're going to convert that.
Exactly a year ago, Daniel, was when we announced the New York Cosmos, and I checked out Randall's Island. I had the taxi driver take me back over the Triborough Bridge instead of bringing me back to LaGuardia. I was flying back from LaGuardia to Fort Lauderdale rather than going under the tunnel or going over to Queensboro. And so I could check out Randall's Island, and the fields there are impeccable, but there's no place to park, so that's not an option.
Yeah. That's definitely not an option. And by the way, apparently the New York Cosmos supporters group, they were saying they can build a train station on the Hell's Gate train bridge, which you saw. It's so high up. There's no place to build a station over there. No place.
Yeah, so I don't think that Randall's Island will work. I had thought it would. That's why I had the cab driver drive me that way, because locals had told me it wouldn't, and I said, no, it'll work. I've seen it on Google Earth, you know. It's different when you see it in person. You realize there's no place to park, and
yep.
you know, you can walk across from Manhattan on the bridge, but you know, people coming from Queens or the Bronx are going to take the Triborough, and they're not going to have a place to park. So
right.
That's not an option. But it's it's going to be difficult. The Man City team has got to find a locale that's permanent, that's not Yankee Stadium. Because I'll tell you, Yankee Stadium will not work for MLS has made so much progress with its soccer-specific stadiums. You can't have a team playing in the baseball stadium.
Exactly. Absolutely. My friend, enjoy Ultras Alive. And, of course, you can hear that on blogtalkradio.com. Thank you very much for your time, my friend, talking about this issue. And I'll talk to you real quickly. I know it's on the air and stuff. You're free tomorrow night for a Gold Cup postgame show?
What time?
10 o'clock.
Yeah, I'll be on.
All right, so join Carter Krishnayer and me tomorrow night for USA Costa Rica Gold Cup postgame show, 10 o'clock Eastern, 7 o'clock Pacific. Thanks, Carter, and enjoy Ultras Alive.
Great, thank you, Daniel.
No problem at all. And welcome back to Forces Fire Net Soccer Show, ladies and gentlemen. How do you like that with those New York Red Bulls? They have a horrible game against Colorado. They come home and they put on a shellacking, 4-0. Let's get straight to the audio with head coach Mike Petke. It's not going.
Good evening, we're Rebels head coach Mike Petke. Mike, what were your thoughts on tonight's match?
It was a great result for us. You know, I thought they, especially the first half, they executed almost everything we wanted them in the pregame, in our video pregame. Second half, as usual, with most teams, you know, the team comes out energized, gets dead down. Sure, the coach really gave it to them at halftime, and they came at us a bit, but we weathered the storm, and got back to how we won in the first half as the second half went on and finished out the game strong.
Hey, questions. Franco, then Brian.
Mike, you guys got 2 goals in the first 16 minutes. I mean, how important was that to set the tone for the game? And obviously, Dan Peggy gets his first almost goal that he won. So, I mean, how big is that for
him? No, it's huge. It's important to go out. We wanted to go out there today and when relevant, to get after him and press him. Not like crazy men, not to run 40 yards to pressure the ball, but when we put ourselves in good situations, it's our home field. We wanted to be the dominant side today, and then to get that one first goal and the second goal and have them playing catch-up, it was a good feeling.
Brian and Christian.
How much of that was any tactical changes that you made, or was this simply the effort that you said you didn't see? I don't want to misquote you, but the effort you didn't see in Colorado. You talked about it this week. You wanted more worker. Was that what this was, or was it something else?
No, well, first I just want to clarify, because the way I said it was not the work rate I wanted to see in Colorado from the coaching staff all the way through the players. I wasn't single out the players. I wanted to make that clear. Yes, it's definitely a huge combination of that. They came out strong, and not only their running, but the ball movement was phenomenal in the first half. But also, we really emphasized on some key things that Montreal does in the pregame. And especially Eric Alexander on the first goal is an exact product of what we pointed out to him, to go after Broski one-on-one when the situation called for it. And amongst other things, the passing channels that were open and our back four seeing those channels, Dak's not dropping too deep early, really listening to what we went over in the pregame. And I think it's a combination of them really stepping up the effort and doing what we as a team pinpointed and they followed through with it.
Christian.
Common theme throughout this year has always been either starting strong or not finishing well, or vice versa. You talk about some big games tonight. This was a good 90 minutes that we've seen from this club so far.
Yeah, I think it might be the most complete game we played this year in terms of score, in terms of certain things, but it wasn't, you know, it's one game, you know? But, I mean, I appreciate it. But it's one game, you know, and these guys know that. We're on the road again next weekend in Toronto, a much improved Toronto team. On top of that, we have a reserve game tomorrow morning and an international friendly Tuesday. So we need to get these guys rested and get prepared for Toronto.
Yeah.
Mike, talking again about Eric Alexander, the effort he put out there tonight was fantastic. Did you try to talk to him about wanting more, and did he happen to see the Clint Mathis goal a long time ago against Dallas?
Listen, I'm... If you go talk to our captain, Thierry Henry, you go talk to Tim Cahill, Dax, pick anyone from that. I've been saying it all year. I know for some reason Eric's been getting some sticks from whether it be the media or the fans about not playing good or whatever. To us, he does very well. We're very happy with Eric's play. Tonight, I think, was a great example of what he's capable of. And then I hope many people don't forget that he's not an outside player. He's someone that we converted to it. And I think he's adapted very well. And tonight, he showed what he could do.
Take home more, Franco.
Just go back. Peggy,
obviously,
get his word
on the penalty. Peggy has a vision of the game that's better than most people. He sees things. His control is great. He's a setup man, and he hasn't been able to find the back of the net. As a forward, that's frustrating. Just as you saw Fabian as well, until he scored 2 weeks ago, and he had an assist tonight, which is great. I think it's very important that Peggy stepped up and took that shot, and he converted it, because, you know, it's all about streaky, and it's all about confidence for foes specifically. And now hopefully if we count on one more that's going to get in a roll, it would be great.
Awesome, here.
Mike, I know it's really early. I know it's July, but you look at the standings, and now the two of you are dead. You don't want to hear it.
Go ahead.
But the two of you are dead even in first place right now. The top five teams are separated by 5 total points. In that respect, how big of a win was this? I don't want to say how vital. How big of a win was this because of where you now stand in the standings?
No, of course. It's always good to look at where, you know, sitting on top of the conference. It's wonderful. But, I mean, I look around here and see so many people who have written for this league for so long. I've played in the league for 13 years. It means absolutely nothing. You know, this is such a streaky league. Even the best teams have their moments going up and down. It's just the way this league is built. You know, and a big, you know, thing that I try to portray to the players is what's really going to set a team apart in this league is their ability to play with the ball. Because everybody in this league wants their ass ball. Everybody's a one-and-done team at times. Everybody puts the effort in. It's not about the effort. If you don't match the effort, you're behind the eight ball when the whistle blows. So first thing is to match the effort. Second thing is to be a better quality side. And tonight we were a better quality side. In Colorado we weren't. Houston we weren't. It's freaking rollercoaster from there.
That's Mike Petke on the match, and let me tell you something. What a complete performance against the Montreal Impact the New York Red Bulls had, and this was unbelievable. Obviously, everyone was down about the 2-0 loss over in Denver, over at Commerce City, Colorado. The New York Red Bulls, they had a decent first half, but it looked like they weren't doing anything special. It looks like they were playing for the draw. And fortunately, they found a way today, or I shouldn't say today, Saturday, they found a way to erase that blunder of a start of a match, and they got a complete performance. 4-0. Eric Alexander, what a performance he had in the first half. 3 times he ran against defenders. 3 times he attacked the net. He went over the crossbar the first attempt, scored a great goal in the 10th minute, had another opportunity in the 32nd, but nailed the crossbar and out. Eric Alexander, normally is a central midfield player, was asked to play wide and has done so, I'll say, decently. He hasn't been great all season long, but he has done a decent job. Could be better. It could be a lot better. But the truth of the matter is this, is that he has done a decent job. It's not that great. It could be better. Maybe we'll see what happens if the Red Bulls find better wide players. And maybe Eric Alexander will be heading back to the bench. You never know. We'll see what happens. But to be honest with you, he's done a decent job. It's not great, but he's done a decent job. And you can say this if you want. He probably could have had probably a hat trick if the other 2 shots he had outside of the goal he scored, if they both went in, could have been a hat trick. Could have been a hat trick. And you know what? I got to tell you, what a goal from Thierry Henry. great cross by Fabian Espíndola, and the way that Henri put the ball on his foot and right into the net, I mean, let's be honest, he didn't take a bad touch. In fact, that touch was so exquisite because he didn't let the ball bounce. Did not let the ball bounce. The ball crossed right onto his right foot and off the, off the left foot, off the inside. And he didn't let it bounce. He just gently, I don't know if you call it a tap, I don't know if you call it a push, or he redirected it towards the net, but you know what? He beats Troy Perkins fantastically, and it just rolled in there like it was nothing. It was like an absolute, oh, it's me. Oh, here's the foot. Oh, it's in. Whatever. I've done this all the time. I mean, fantastic goal by Thierry Henry. Absolutely brilliant. I mean, you cannot say enough about how that ball was scored and put right into the net. It was absolutely exquisite. I mean, you'll never see a better touch like that at all. Absolutely brilliant stuff. And other things going on as well in this match. They just attacked and attacked and attacked. Obviously, you're going in at half up 2-0. You worry about maybe Montreal getting off to a quick start. Maybe the Red Bulls get off to a slow start. Montreal did get off to a hot start, and you know what? They had an opportunity, and unfortunately, Marco Davao offside, unfortunately for Montreal. Marco Davao, who thought he got one, pulled one back. It got wiped out, and if you see the replay, great call. He's just a half yard offside. So great call there by the assistant referee on the far side. And then here come the Red Bulls again. And it's all Tim Cahill and Thierry Henry. And you have to say for Tim Cahill, obviously, another goal off the head from a corner. It was absolutely fantastic. And you got to say, once again, it was just absolutely brilliant from Tim Cahill, because he comes on from the corner. Thierry Henry with a brilliant cross from the far corner. And here comes Tim Cahill, who buries it into the back of the net. Great header. No one marking the Australian. And he makes it 3-0. And the South were chanting, "We want four, we want four." And it looked like it was going to happen, and it did, because Lloyd Sam, who came on as a substitute, came in to the area, two defenders coming at him, one next to him, one behind him, gets tripped up in the area by the defender behind him, just enough of a swipe trips him up in the area. Penalty to the Red Bulls, their first penalty on the season, and a clear penalty. And who does Thierry Henry hand the ball to? The captain hands the ball to Peggy Luyendula, who finally gets his first chance at on goal due to the spot kick, converts it to the right of him inside the near post. Peggy Luyendula, finally, his first goal in Major League Soccer, his first goal with the Red Bulls. It's been coming for a while, and finally he gets that opportunity and converts to make it 4-0. Stoppage time was about 2 minutes. It was all over. And you got to say, finally, Peggy Luyendula can smile. He can get all that, all those, you know, all of the weight off of his shoulders to finally say, "Hey, I finally got my goal." And he finally got it. Good for him. It all finished up 4-0. And I'm very, very happy to see Peggy Lou Yandula do well. Of course, informing my friends over at French Football Weekly on what's been going on with Peggy Lou Yandula and Thierry Henry, and they've done a fantastic, just to help them out, to let them know. Montreal Impact just did not seem themselves. The Montreal Impact does not seem to be the force that they were when the season got underway. And you just have to say that for Montreal, now tied for second in the East with the Red Bulls, even though they have two games in hand to play, Sporting Kansas City does take over top spot in the East. So we'll see what happens the rest of the way. But don't forget, this has been a fantastic match for the Red Bulls. From start to finish, they were absolutely brilliant. And, of course, who else is happy but the captain of this club in Thierry Henry?
Do you feel this was the most complete performance of the season so far?
Yes. I think it was. We had to respond after the game against Colorado, so we did. But I always say, we got only 3 points tonight, so we have to concentrate on Toronto and make sure that we can compete over there.
What is it about Montreal? You scored 7 goals in 4 matches against them.
I don't know, man.
With the two goals, obviously, Eric dribbles right through guys and slots the ball to the far corner and usually tap in on the 5 minutes, cross 8 minutes later, so 2 goals in 16 minutes, how important was that for you guys to set the tone early?
It was very important. We wanted to start very strong, which I thought we did at the time. Then we kept on going. I think that was the key, apart from the beginning of the second half, the first 5 minutes we were not there for some reason. Other than that, I thought that we were pretty consistent, and although Dibayo had a couple of look at times, but I thought the defense played really well and we scored exactly when we needed to.
Was there anything tactical that you guys thought you could take advantage of, or was that work rate?
I think it was work rate. I think we had a bad day at the office the other day against Colorado. And maybe the same thing happened for Montreal tonight.
Do you feel this was the most complete performance of the season so far?
Yes. We had to respond after the game against Colorado, so we did. But I will always say, we've got only 3 points tonight, so we have to concentrate on top.
Let's try that again. I don't know what happened. We're going to try that again. Hopefully it doesn't reset again, but we'll see what happens. Once again, Thierry Henry.
Do you feel this was the most complete performance of the season so far?
Yes. We had to respond after the game against Colorado, so we did. But I will always say, we've got only 3 points tonight, so we have to concentrate on Toronto and make sure that we can compete over there.
What is it about Montreal? You scored 7 goals in 4 matches against them.
I don't know, man.
with the 2 goals, obviously, Eric dribbles right through guys and slots the ball to the far corner, and usually tap in on the 5 minutes cross 8 minutes later. So 2 goals in 16 minutes, how important was that for you guys to set the tone early?
It was very important. We wanted to start very strong, which I thought we did at the time. Then we kept on going. I think that was the key, apart from the beginning of the second half, the first 5 minutes we were not there for some reason. Other than that, I thought that we were pretty consistent, and although Dibayo had a couple of look at times, but I thought the defense played really well and we scored exactly when we needed to.
Was there anything tactical that you guys thought you could take advantage of, or was that work rate? I mean, was that just kind of
I think it was worth it. I think we had a bad day at the office the other day against Colorado, and maybe the same thing happened for Montreal tonight. You know.
Do you feel this was the most complete performance?
All right. Unfortunately, we're having some problems with the Henri audio. So we're going to move on, and we'll definitely get the man who basically scored his first goal in Major League Soccer, and that is Peggy Lou Yandula.
The career accomplishments you've had, it's kind of funny to hear your teammates congratulating you on getting your first goal with the club.
Yeah. It's a real pleasure for me. I was waiting for that since a long time. After my late game, after my injuries, and it's good to be congratulated by some guys who share French passion. So it's really good because you can feel what I was feeling when I was not scoring. So good to feel to have got a good. Were you surprised to get the call on the shot? He know me, we know each other since a long time, and you know that I was waiting for that goal, so it's a high class year.
Any pressure going into it?
No, because I know that when I choose my side, I usually take it right, but I was in a bad moment because ever since I was kicking the ball to the net, he was stopping or wide. So for that one, I was thinking a little bit because he was giving me the ball to make me score. And if I didn't score, it was bad, but it was cool because he gave me power, you know.
What did he say to you before the kick and then after the kick? Because I think he was the first one to join you.
Before, he didn't say nothing. After, he said first of all that he was sure that I'm gonna make it, and it was like, if you didn't.
After all these months, you said you were talking to me about how frustrated you've been last before, and then today, obviously, you didn't speak anymore. And you had a little bit of a long wait while you were in the preparatory. What were you thinking when you were standing there?
No, I was really waiting for the referee because he was talking with someone, and I was like, I have to take my time, then be stressy or anxious. So I was just waiting. I wasn't that sure that I would make the goal, but I was pretty sure. And then I was okay, if you just take your time, you gotta make it.
Did you know where you were gonna go start, or did you think about it while you were there, making the left, right, up, down?
You know, usually I always wait the step of the goalkeeper, but on this moment I have to score, so I have to just choose a way and just hit it hard.
You started against Montreal early in the season. The second game was a 2-1 victory at Red Bull Arena around, I think, March or April.
May, thank you.
What was about Montreal today differently? Maybe you saw while you were warming up, getting ready to sub in, that maybe something was not right about Montreal?
I think there was Arnold with less power than the previous game. But that happens. You know, sometimes you just begin the game bad and it turns down. So it wasn't a game for us, for them.
And that's Peggy Lou Yandula, ladies and gentlemen. And as we... as we get ready for other things going on. You know, this is a game where the Red Bulls really, really you know, really needed it really badly. They really needed this game because it's just one of those things where you have to go, and obviously it's a situation where they just really, really needed to go out and do a job. They just really needed to go out there and do a job. And hopefully they'll continue to play it like this, and hopefully they can go out there and do a better job in trying to, you know, get stuff ready to go and get stuff to move forward and, you know, to probably try and reclaim first place and see what they do in the East. So it's just one of those things where for the New York Red Bulls, they need more consistency, obviously. They can't lay eggs on the road. We know they're strong at home. That's not the problem. We all know that's not the problem. The problem is this. It's having to be consistent, not just at home, but to be consistent on the road. That's what it has to be. That's what it needs to be. And hopefully for the Red Bulls, that's what's going to happen, because it really needs to happen big time. And hopefully these situations will come up big, and hopefully these situations will happen for the Red Bulls, and everything will be fine, and everything will be okay, and we won't have to worry so much anymore about, I guess, little surprises. Eric Alexander, once again, great match for him. He got his goal, second of the season, and here's his opinions about the match.
What about your goal today and the 4-0 win against Montreal?
I don't really remember too much. I haven't seen a replay. Just remember getting the final touch on the inside and was able to slide it home.
It seemed like a Chandler Jenner method. Because you had three guys after you making a run, and then you slide it into the far corner. So, and then you hit the post late in the first. I mean, how confident were you in that first half? You were just fine.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of space in the game. It was hot out. Transition stuff for both teams, and you know, I think when the game's open up like that, especially there's a lot of space in the wings, and you know, I was getting good balls from my teammates, and then they were making good off the ball runs just to get me in one-on-one situations.
Were you surprised it gave you that much room?
No, like I said before, you know, it's pretty warm out. It's tough to transition, and you know, we'd win balls and we were playing forward quickly, and you know, we knew those spaces were going to be open before the game started.
How good are you feeling right now, just as a player and with the team too, getting a big win, but also yourself getting the goal and then just playing well and being able to create?
You know, I feel good. Obviously, it's nice to score, but I thought overall it was a good team performance, and that's more important at this stage in the season, especially when, you know, all these points are going to add up in the end. So I think it was a big home win for us.
Was it the team's best performance of the year? Obviously, 4-0 against the first place team in the East, pretty hard to predict for that.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, definitely one of our top. I don't know about best, but it was definitely a very good performance.
How comfortable are you feeling out on the right now? Obviously, you're a central midfielder, and you've been on the right side for most of this year, so obviously there was a transition period and getting used to it and everything. I mean, are you feeling more comfortable now?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say I was ever uncomfortable. It's just, you know, learning to play the position with how the other guys around you expect to play it. So it was different from when I played it before, when I was playing in Portland, and you know, I played a little bit in Dallas as well. So overall, I think, you know, I'm pretty comfortable now, and you know where guys expect me to be and the movements I need to make.
Did this make up for the flat tire you got during the week? They took the picture out of you sitting there on the time and help them.
Well, I mean, they weren't helping either. They were just taking pictures. So.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
That's Eric Alexander for you. Now let's see if we have the Thierry Henry audio ready. Let's see here. Okay, that one didn't work. Let's try this one again.
Do you feel this was the most complete performance of the season so far?
Yes. I think it was. think we had to respond after the game against Colorado, so we did. But like I will always say, we got only 3 points tonight, so we have to concentrate on Toronto and make sure that we can compete over there.
What is it about Montreal? You scored 7 goals in 4 matches against them.
I don't know, man.
I'm born with the 2 goals. Obviously, Eric dribbles right through guys and slots the ball to the far corner, and then usually tap in on a 5-minute cross 8 minutes later. So 2 goals in 16 minutes. How important was that for you guys to set the tone early?
It was very important. We wanted to start very strong, which I thought we did at the time. Then we kept on going. I think that was the key. Apart from the beginning of the second half, the first 5 minutes we were not there for some reason. Other than that, I thought that we were pretty consistent. And although Dibayo had a couple of look at times, but I thought the defense played really well and we scored exactly when we needed to.
Was there anything tactical that you guys thought you could take advantage of, or was that work rate?
I think we had a bad day at the office the other day against Colorado, and maybe the same thing happened for Montreal tonight.
Do you feel this was the most complete?
All right. Unfortunately, we're not having good audio here with Thierry Henry, unfortunately, and we're going to move forward here. I guess Tim Cahill. Last moment here is with Tim Cahill, and see if I can try and fix this audio problem here. And here's Tim Cahill on the performance of the club.
Browns offense, defense. I mean, it's about as good as you guys can play.
I think today was all about the reaction after the way we played last week. You know, we know that we're a lot better than what we were last week, and it was a massive game for us. You know, there was a lot at stake, I suppose, position-wise, also points and how many games we've played, but the mentality that we've taken from Monday leading into this game was to put right the last game that we played, and I felt that we did that on every level. And when you get the goals and you get the defensive performance and the fluidity of the play, you know, for me, I'm very happy. I was playing with a smile on my face, and so a lot of the other lads. And I suppose it's a good day for everyone.
How good is it to see Peggy get on the score sheet, open his account, and get his reward? Obviously, looking for that goal for some time now.
Yeah, it's fantastic for Peggy. You know, it's fantastic for the team, because that's what we're all about: looking after each other, making sure that we have this bond that we look after every player. And you know, it showed on the pitch today. It was exceptional. That the fans were brilliant. That's a great stadium, great pitch, and Montreal an exceptional team. And today, the mentality had to be we had to stop the good players playing, and that's what we did. We're in their face regardless of the humidity and the conditions, and we made sure that our tempo was a lot higher than theirs. And, you know, I'm pretty sure they felt it.
What was your vantage point on your goal?
Just, you know, found a bit of space, and you know, got good contact. And you have to wait for moments like that in the game. Not many come for me, because you know, when they played Bernier in there and the other midfielder, they were quite solid and defensive. And, you know, me and Dax couldn't go as much, and well, lucky enough, the boys got the 2 goals, and in the end, I have to wait for opportunities. You know, it's not a game where I need to score goals. It's basically, if I get them chances, then I'm going to put them away, and just unlucky not to get the second, but overall, I'm just buzzing for the boys.
How big was the ball movement today? I mean, it seemed like your passes were crisp right from the beginning. And is that the key if you're going to move forward? You need to be able to share the ball and move the ball around.
Yeah, definitely. I suppose for us is to keep the ball, try and penetrate the defense more, and try and get forward and, you know, turn the defenders. You know, today I think we turned them quite a lot, and also kept the ball very well. There's obviously areas we could have done better, but overall it was a solid team performance.
Did you feel that even though you're up 2-0 at the half, that you really need a third one to kill off the game?
Yeah, you always need a third, but you know, there's no pressure on us. We're quite chilled. You know, we just need to make sure defensively that we're, you know, adapted to our circumstances, and maybe we could have started off a bit better. But and when the third one went in, then it, you know, it was shut the gates, and you know, we could relax.
Did you know Eric had that inner Messi in him, dribbling by 3 guys?
Look, he's an exceptional player. He's someone that's kind of above and beyond the call of duty for this team. And He's one of the most important players in this team, and it's great because he's confident, and it's great to see him score goals like that. But mostly, you know, he's developing as a player, and that's what we want for him.
And that's Tim Cahill on the match, especially you know, raving about Eric Alexander and how he performed in the match today. And obviously, ladies and gentlemen, it's just one of those things where you just have to say that while, like we've said before, you know, the players know more about what goes on behind the scenes. And it's one of those things where you just have to say that for the Red Bulls, you know, there's been some issues with the wide play, especially the wide midfielders. I mean, Johnny Steele and Eric Alexander, you know, yes, they've been working hard, and maybe you don't see the quality come out as quickly as possible, but the point is simple, is that you probably need maybe a little bit better quality on the wings than we are seeing right now. Obviously, Lloyd Sam is trying to get more playing time if he can, and, you know, the injury that he had towards the end of last year, you know, that's probably has got, not to say it's been in Petke's doghouse, but more so about maybe his fitness wasn't there, and Sam's been coming off the bench more than he has starting. But we'll see what happens as the season continues on. Obviously, there's still two matches remaining in July. They still have August, September, and October going on before the playoffs begin in November. And they are in a good position right now, the New York Red Bulls, still in MLS, while still tied on points in the East with Montreal. You also have to wonder how the situation is, because, yes, Kansas City is in first place right now. They have 33 points. Montreal and New York are tied for second with 31, even though the games played department, Montreal has two games in hand. So we'll see how that plays out as well. And, you know, it all depends on who they're going to be bringing in, the Red Bulls, who they're going to try and bring in. Obviously, they have some trialists in at the moment. But hopefully for the Red Bulls that everything will be going very well and there won't be any more problems coming in, and we'll see what happens. But once again, it's going to be interesting. Now, here's some information, obviously, most of you have probably already knew about, and that is, of course, the brother of Kaká in Digao. Digao has been cut from the Red Bulls through sources toward Christian Dier of basically Christian Dier has reported through sources that they cut Digao. And, of course, that's $200,000, let's be honest, that really, really, you know, needed to be let go on. Really, really needed to be let go on. And you just have to say that it was needed. I mean, he was injured. He really didn't need to be, you know, it was just a waste of $200,000, and that's it. Done. Goodbye. So long. Farewell. And it's not just that. Of course, the Red Bulls are going to get some much-needed cap room. But the thing is, you got two players that either A, were not needed to be here, B, you know, trying to bring people, certain people over that probably, you know, so it's just one of those things where, hey, what are you going to do? But now we'll see what's going to happen. Now we're going to see what the situation is going to be, because obviously it's just one of those things. I don't know. But they never – it's just one of those things where I just don't think it was needed to have someone like Digao on this roster, if you're just there to basically allow Kaká to come in here whenever he's done. I think, you know, I just think it's just not needed at all. And I'm glad to see that the Red Bulls finally sending him away, because he really wasn't needed. And hopefully, you know, just get rid of him. Just get rid of him. They do nothing for the roster. They do So other than that, that's the situation that you see with this whole roster purge. That's the situation you see going on here. It's just one of those things where I just believe that it was not needed. Not needed at all. And hopefully we'll see what's going to happen. Now, hopefully I've fixed the audio problem with Thierry Henry with the audio. So let's see if we can try that again. Here he is.
Do you feel this was the most complete performance of the season so far?
Yes. I think it was. We had to respond after the game against Colorado, so we did. But I will always say. We got only 3 points tonight, so we have to concentrate on Toronto and make sure that we can compete over there.
What is it about Montreal? You scored 7 goals in 4 matches against them.
I don't know, man.
I'm growing with the 2 goals. Obviously, Eric dribbles right through guys and slots the ball to the far corner, and usually tap in on a 5-minute cross. 8 minutes later, saw 2 goals in 60 minutes on 4. Was that for you guys to set the tone early?
It was very important. We wanted to start very strong, which I thought we did at the time. Then we kept on going. I think that was the key. Apart from the beginning of the second half, for that, you know, the first 5 minutes we were not there for some reason. Other than that, I thought that we were pretty consistent. And although Dubai had a couple of look at times, but I thought the defense played really well and we scored exactly when we needed to.
Was there anything tactical that you guys thought you could take advantage of, or was that work rate? I mean, was that just
I think it was work rate. I think we had a bad day at the offense the other day against Colorado, and maybe the same thing happened for Montreal tonight.
Do you feel this was the most complete?
All right. Tried to save the audio as much as I could. Unfortunately, something did not go right. So, unfortunately, we're going to have to not play the whole thing. And I apologize for that, ladies and gentlemen. My equipment was not – I don't know why the equipment was not acting well enough. It sounded okay when I recorded it, but I guess we have some issues here that – that needs to be fixed. So, unfortunately, we've lost some good stuff, but that's okay. We won't worry about it. Just want to let everyone know, if anyone's watching Gold Cup today, El Salvador gets a 1-0 victory over Haiti, and that penalty that El Salvador got, I have to say, was a bit dubious, because to me, it just felt like that wasn't a penalty. If the attacker was grabbing on to the, to his defender's jersey. So I just felt that's not a penalty. Not a penalty at all. And it's just one of those things where you just have to say that things could have been a lot better. Maybe a 0-0 draw wouldn't have been that bad. But there you go. It's all over. And now it looks like here between Honduras and Trinidad and Tobago. I don't know if there's a penalty being awarded. Nope, it's a free kick. We're in the beginning of the match. So basically, it's just one of those things where you just have to say that it would be interesting, and we'll see what goes on and everything. But other than that, you know, it's just one of those things. Now, don't forget, ladies and gentlemen, the New York Red Bulls will be hosting a friendly this Tuesday night against Olympique Lyonnais from French Ligue 1. And I will be missing that match. I will not be in attendance tomorrow, as it will be during the, at the same time, the CONCACAF Gold Cup Group C match between the USA and Costa Rica. So I will be hosting a post-game show at 10 o'clock. Now, locally, it will be on television. You can watch it on MSG. And just to let everyone know, Thierry Henry will not be performing against Lyon. So it's just one of those things where it's a good thing because, to be honest with you, if the friendly was on a Wednesday, I would have gone. But the friendly's not on a Wednesday, so I'm not going. And once again, you know, this is just to help Olympique Lyonnais with their preseason. Obviously, Gerard Houllier is giving them a second chance to come back to Red Bull Arena to face the Red Bulls. They were here last year for the Coupe de Champions as the League One winners faced the Coupe de France winners, which was Olympique Lyonnais and Montpellier. Obviously, that will be somewhere else this time around. Where, I don't know. I didn't really find out. But I will say that, obviously, the match between the USA and Costa Rica, it's very important. We know the U.S. is going to the quarterfinals. Of the Gold Cup, and of course, it's just one of those things where you know, I got to cover the USA game. It's a more important game. As I said before, we know they're going to the quarterfinals, but once again, if the USA can draw or win against Costa Rica, they'll stay in first place and they'll win Group C, and that's probably more important. Not probably. It is more important to have that match than a friendly like this against Lyon. If they, like I said before, if the friendly was on Wednesday, I would go to the friendly. But, you know, it's a meaningless match. Henry is not performing. Not that that's a big deal or anything like that. But still, I still feel that this is much more important. Very, very important, as the USA is playing. The USA is playing here, and it's just one of those things where I just believe that it's a lot better. It's a lot better to go and do the USA game and, you know, it's a much better thing. It's just, you know, that's why I'm having a CONCACAF Gold Cup post-game show tomorrow. And then, of course, let's not forget when next month comes around, CONCACAF Champions League group stage matches will get underway. Of course, we'll review the games involving Sporting Kansas City, the Los Angeles Galaxy, the Houston Dynamo, San Jose Earthquakes, as they will be in the same group with Canada's Montreal Impact, and we'll see what the Impact will do in international competition as they get ready for three matches in August, two matches in September, and one match in October. So it's going to be exciting. It's going to be a lot of fun. I know I cannot wait. As we keep going here on the Four Seasons Fire Internet Soccer Show, I want to go back to you guys and just say, listen, I appreciate you guys going back to some of my older shows, back in my older shows. Thank you so much for taking a listen to those old shows because, you know, I got to tell you, it really warms my heart when you guys go back all the way 2010, 2011, 2012, of course. Those shows are not that old, but I just have to say once again, thank you so much for doing this, for listening to these past shows and making this a popular live streaming and a podcast as well when you go to the archive. You know, this is something, you know, that you want. You want this. You're looking for someone that wants to give, you know, credibility to this sport. And I'm not saying everyone else who covers MLS is not giving it credibility. But if you're looking for someone that, you know, definitely pays attention to and, you know, look, I am like you guys. Now, I want to see the game in this country dominate. I want to see the game in this country improving every single match, every single season, every single year, every single qualifier, everything. And we have to be like this. I try not to be overly critical, but to be honest with you, I try to be a little more demanding than what's been going on here. And when it comes to the Red Bulls, maybe I try to find some positives when something does not go right. Maybe I'm trying to find some positives on what this situation goes with Mike Petke. I know there are some that felt that Petke's time was up, but you know what? What does he do? He recognizes the situation. He understood what went wrong. And so what does he do? He fixes it, corrects it, gets ready for the next match, and boom. He gets the opportunity to get a win. Not just a win, a freaking blowout. Marco Schellenbaum is currently going through a slump. The Montreal Impact right now is going through a slump. They've been knocked off the top of the perch. So basically, that's all I'm saying. I think there's an opportunity for Mike Petke to grow. And he's done that. He's learned. Everyone knew what happened in Colorado. It was the biggest egg they've laid all season. The biggest egg that was laid all season. And then they turn around and they dominate to give you a 4-0. Now, obviously, Toronto, and let's be honest, so we'll see what's going to happen. They got to go up to Toronto, go to BMO Field this coming Saturday. And they're going to have to go and dominate against a team that is really one of the worst teams in the league and one of the worst teams in the Eastern Conference. DC is definitely worse. But right now, all I can say is this. The New York Red Bulls need to get another 3 points and then get ready for the Saturday after when they host Real Salt Lake. So basically, that's the situation we have in front of us. And that's all I can say. That's the situation we have here. This is what's going on. But then again, August and September is coming around. A couple of road games over in Houston. Sounds like Houston's right at the ship. I know we're getting ahead of ourselves, obviously, but obviously the September games are going to go on the road in sport at Sporting Park. And then they got to go back to Columbus. Then they come home for Philadelphia. Then they make a West Coast trip to play Chivas USA. Then they come back to face DC United. And then they're going to have a couple of games at home and on the road in Houston, home against Toronto, against FC Dallas that comes over here. Chicago will make a trip over here. And I think that's about it, to be honest with you. I can always double check and make sure that I got my information correctly. So I can go and check on the calendar here and make sure. So once again, this coming Saturday, Red Bulls are at Toronto. Then on the 27th of July, they'll be hosting Real Salt Lake. And then in August, they will be at Sporting Kansas City on the 3rd. Then on the 10th, at the Columbus Crew. Then they come back home on the 17th against Philadelphia. And then they go to Chivas USA on the 25th. And then they come home to face DC United on the 31st. And then in September, they will be home on the 8th. I'm sorry, that's my bad. They will be at Houston on the 8th on Sunday. A couple of Sunday games. And then they'll be home against Toronto on September the 14th. And then the Red Bulls will be home on the 22nd as they take on FC Dallas. And they go back. I shouldn't say they go back. They go to Seattle on the 29th. And that'll be a 9 o'clock Eastern time start. In October, they'll be home against the Revolution on the 5th, and then there'll be World Cup qualifying going on, so there'll be a break. Then on the 20th, the Red Bulls will be at Houston. Then on the 27th, the Red Bulls will be home against Chicago. And that's the end of the regular season, and then, of course, we'll see where they go and if they'll be doing any hosting, second leg stuff. We'll see what happens. And it should be cool. It should be great. And I cannot wait to see what's going to happen. A lot of fun. A lot of fun coming up here in these final moments. The second half of the season going on here in for the Red Bulls. And it should be a lot of fun. Should be exciting. And, of course, right now, Gold Cup update for you. If you like Honduras 0, Trinidad and Tobago 0. This is in the 23rd minute right now. A lot of interesting things going on here in the standings. Obviously, Honduras right now, they're going to basically win. They automatically have won their group, so Honduras and El Salvador will be going to the quarterfinals. It all depends about Trinidad and Tobago right now. If they lose to Honduras, obviously they're out. If they win, then Haiti's knocked out, and Trinidad and Tobago will be one of the two best third place finishers. If it's a draw, Haiti will advance. And then, to be honest with you, it all depends on how many goals Cuba and Belize need to score to get a win to take one of those third place finishers. Because at the moment, Martinique is in third with a minus two. Haiti has the other one right now with a minus one. But I want to give thanks to my good friend Carter Kirschneier for being on the show tonight. And everyone else, thank you for listening to tonight's show. Talk to you tomorrow for the post-game show between the USA and Costa Rica. And as always, please enjoy your football. Thank you and have a good night, everybody.